Hi, I'm Jesse Hirsch. Welcome to the Future Herd. Today we've got an exciting roundup of our recent episodes around food security in the form of a panel hosted by Jen McTavish, who is not only a previous guest, but also the interim executive director of the Agricultural Adaptation Council. And this kind of marks a milestone in this podcast, both in the way that we're trying to synthesize our discussions and analysis of food security, but also as a way of tying this into the larger Agri-Food 2050 process. I'm a big methods person. On the one hand, I believe quite firmly in the spontaneous conversation, but I also think it's important to try to synthesize and connect the dots and really turn raw data into synthesized knowledge and insights. And quite frankly, that's what we're trying to do with today's panel. Before we join it, a reminder about our commons.thefutureherd.ca website, where we ask you to share your views. And I'd also point out that another regular feature of our website is an intelligence brief that I set up for my own personal purposes of learning more and keeping tabs on the agri-food industry. But like all the research I do, it's open source and there for you to consume. So check out our intelligence briefing near daily that has highlights and changes and stories about what's going on in the agri-food sector. All right, let's throw to Jen and the panel.
So we're doing something a little different today on the Future Herd. My name is Jen McTavish. I'm taking the mic over from Jesse Hirsch, and I'm hosting a panel discussion. I'm bringing three previous guests back to the table to talk about something I've been thinking a lot about lately. What does a resilient agri-food industry look like? So I'm excited today to chat with Camden Lawrence, First Nations Agriculture and Finance Ontario, Lori Nickel, CEO of Second Harvest, which is Canada's largest food rescue organization, and Tyler McCann, Managing Director of the Canadian Agri-Food Policy Institute. Camden, Lori, Tyler, welcome back to the Future Herd table.
It's great to be back.
To get us started, I'm going to ask each of you an overarching question, and I think I'd like to start with Camden this morning. When I say a resilient agri-food sector, what does that look like to you?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. We know that a lot of, we rely heavily on a lot of our products being produced not in Ontario or Canada. So I think the main thing in being resilient is getting a lot more production in the province, in the country. And then what we do produce, then it's creating the processing and all the infrastructure and whatever else is needed to then keep as much as we can local. And local, I mean, we say local as a small area, but even just, our organization services the whole province. So it's how can we all work together as a province to, better serve everyone around us, right?
Great. Lori, what about you? What does resilient agri-food sector mean to you?
Well, I would agree 100% with everything Camden said. But I would also add that a resilient system really looks at the food waste that's happening in it and manages it much better. When we're wasting 46.5% of all the food produced for us in Canada, we've got a problem. So how do we integrate food waste prevention, food waste minimization to ensure that we're producing and Canadians are eating it? Like we are very good at producing food in Canada. We are not very good at making sure it gets eaten. So I think any kind of national strategy must include food waste inside of it.
Tyler?
So I think I think about this a little bit different. If you think about the definition of resilience from an ecosystem's perspective, often what you're talking about is the ability of a system to absorb shocks, maintain its kind of core functions, and then respond and recover from them. And so I think our food system is it needs to be able to kind of deal with everything that's getting thrown at it, and let's acknowledge that there seems to be more things being thrown at it today than it is before, and it just needs to be able to respond and recover. This is very different than a food system that's growing, a food system that's improving. And so I think in my mind, resilience really is just kind of the bottom line, the foundation for everything else that needs to come after it.
I'm just going to build on the terms you use. When you talk about respond and recover, to me, coming from a livestock background, that sounds very much like emergency management, right? We prepare, we respond, we recover. And I know in the livestock sector, there's a lot of work getting done around emergency management for the next, you know, animal health problem that hits us. And when we look at agri-food kind of from a broader spectrum, and we like zoom out, when we talk about agri-food resiliency, are we really talking about kind of that emergency preparedness, that emergency response? So when we're dealing with Mother Nature being what she is right now this spring, not able to make up her mind, right through to, you know, what's happening with trade. Should we really be, this might be too big of a question so early in the podcast, but should we really be looking at this more like emergency response?
So I think if you go back to that ecosystem kind of definition, often they're talking about things like wildfires, like how can you respond to a wildfire? And I think that just the parallel is similar, whether or not we're talking about trade or these other things. But I think kind of resilience has become a very trendy word today. And I think that it sometimes loses that original context around responding and recovering. And so I think that that's where, if that's what we are talking about, kind of the true resilience, it is effectively about emergency management. But again, I think we just have to keep in mind that those emergencies are coming faster and kind of from many different places than they have in the past.
So if we do look, maybe I'll start with you on this next question, Lori. If we look at the entire food system, and you focus specifically on food waste, where do you think our most urgent gap is in terms of being able to build resiliency into our food system?
I mean, it's complicated to implement, but I actually don't think it's that complicated. And it's just measuring it. You know, you manage what you measure, and we measure it consistently. Like, that's one of the biggest challenges in this country, is that nothing is harmonized. So, or measured the same way, you know, in the same system. So just a harmonization of measuring it and setting a goal. This is our goal. This is what's getting measured. How you do it in your own business, as long as you're meeting certain controls. Ultimately, we know that works, right? We know it works because other countries are doing it. And like, we're far behind in Canada, and they're tying food waste strategies inside of their, you know, food security strategies and domestic supply chain strategies. And we're just behind. And that is one of the reasons that we also have a lot of these emergency systems, right? Like, we know that food going in a landfill is a direct contributor to the climate crisis, right? Methane is bad. And so they're all kind of rolled in together. And there's a lot of smaller things we could be doing. Like, I could go on ad nauseum about best before dates, but like, let's just start baseline, foundational. Let's just measure. Because to Camden's point, right, there's a lot of food that we actually could be eating if we had the right infrastructure as well in this country, and we don't. And so, and I want to talk to Camden later, because we're doing a mapping of manufacturing and processing across the country, and I think you'd have a lot to add, which would be really helpful.
Yeah, and I can add to that, and kind of like the project, you know, the food waste idea was, we're now pushing in many of our First Nation communities. They have small, you know, a garden for themselves, a little operation for themselves, and we're trying to push the idea of commercial. One, it hits, commercial brings income into the community as the food goes out. But on the other side, if it's in the community, one, we're creating jobs, but then all of the food waste, it's just going to be almost a partnership with the food bank or another organization in the community, the seniors home or anything like that. And it's just a cycle that, you know, though it's commercial, there's almost a zero waste. As in, we'll find a way if it's in a tight community, when it's more just a commercial for income, you know, it's the waste is the waste, and you're looking for a tax write-off, right? Where if it's in kind of a community structure, it's we have this extra food or this vegetable that doesn't look good or this chicken that didn't make weight, you know, where can it go, right? And they can feed someone that needs that.
Cool. Can we just talk a little bit, you know, one of the there was a paper recently published by the Errol Food Institute, and they were talking about the weaknesses in our supply chain, and they talk about that sort of messy middle. It's like infrastructure, data, cold storage. Both Laurie and Camden, you have brought up like transportation, data, you know, making sure we collect all the same information consistently across the board. Do you have any ideas or suggestions about like low-hanging fruit that we could be addressing that could tackle some of these challenges and that messy middle easily? I'm just sort of opening that up to the floor to see if anybody has any thoughts on that.
You kind of threw us on the easily part because nothing's easy. But having a plan. Yeah. I mean, we've spent at Second Harvest the last 7 years building out an infrastructure to manage surplus food across this country through cold chain, you know, warehousing, where we're hit again and again is manufacturing. Like you get 3 million pounds of potatoes in one call and you're like, okay, well, they have to be washed and bagged. Where are you going to do that? So I think one of the funding streams from the federal government has been really helpful, and that was the Local Food Infrastructure Fund, as well as the Student Nutrition Infrastructure Fund to support community organizations that are preparing food for school programs. So I think we do need, it's not low-hanging fruit, but it is because it is kind of an ongoing funding stream. So there's ways of building out an infrastructure. And I will go back to saying this, right? Like, we're building out an infrastructure to support charities and nonprofits with food. The reality is it's an income issue and they should have enough money to buy their own food. So this is not something I feel strongly about, like, wow, we have this great network and infrastructure, but at some point I want it to just be taken over by some corporation because we've managed the poverty issue with appropriate income.
Tyler, Camden, do you have any thoughts on that?
I mean, I think that to go back to kind of the easy and low hanging fruit and to kind of build off what Laurie said earlier about measuring, you know, I don't think that we know, the problem is that we don't really know, right? Kind of where the easy parts are to fix in some places. I think we have a sense of kind of what they are, but if we really want to start with acting, we do need to be able to dial down a little bit more. And I think that there's a difference between what's easy and what's most impactful. And I think sometimes we have a hard time understanding, do we want to prioritize what's easy, what the low hanging fruit is, or do we want to prioritize the things that are going to make a bigger difference? Because often easy is marginal differences and marginal impacts. And that may not be the right place to really focus our efforts at the end of the day.
Thank you for that pushback. I appreciate that. And I think it's a really important differentiation. And so, you know, when we look at the National Food Security Strategy that's been announced by the Canadian government and some of the commitments that they have made, I guess the question that comes down are the funding announcements they've made, are they impactful? Are they going to move the needle, do you think, in terms of a food resilient system in Canada? What would you say would be missing?
So I think there's two different issues, right? There's the efforts around incomes and income support that will have some impact on lower income Canadians and hopefully put some more money in their pockets to be able to kind of address their food insecurity concerns. I don't think that we have enough details yet around the other parts of that announcement. I mean, there was language around investing in things that will reduce friction along the supply chain. I'm not sure that we know yet what that means or what that looks like to know whether or not it's going to make a difference or not.
Yeah, and the only funding stream I've heard of is a continuation of LFIF at about 20 million. And helpful, sure, but building out an infrastructure across the country, 20 million is not much money to make a meaningful impact.
Yeah. And I think the root for the question for me is I was chatting with somebody the other day and we were talking about how, you know, if the federal government came to us and said, okay, what do you need to build a more resilient strategy? Is the industry really ready to answer that question? Do we have like the top three things that we need to make sure that we, you know, we could build a more resilient food system? And I guess that's a question for you, for all of you. Like, do you have in mind like two or three things that we would absolutely need today to build a more resilient food system?
But Jen, I think you need to start by defining what you mean by a more resilient food system, right? I think that we kind of gloss over that, and I think that yes, we do, right? We need to understand what our critical inputs are and what the weaknesses are on it through a critical input strategy. We need to understand what our infrastructure choke points are and make sure that we've got that. And that doesn't just mean the Port of Vancouver. That means, cold chain storage and where that's going. And then we need to have an understanding around where are the really tight economic challenges, and often that means can Canadians afford to eat in the food insecurity context, and that's a different set of issues. So I think that there are kind of three low-hanging fruits if what we want is to really understand the weaknesses of our food supply system in Canada. But again, I think a lot of people will answer that differently because they're going to be thinking about something different when they think about a more resilient food system.
I think what they're looking to do is strengthen Canadian supply chain, right? And one of the choke points is lack of processing and manufacturing to keep food that we produce in this country from going out and then coming back. So there certainly is an infrastructure, a commercial infrastructure challenge across this country that has been identified, I think, across the board, that needs some major support there. And I'm always going to go back to, they need to address food waste in this country because that's the choke point, right? Like, if you have all this surplus food, commercial or charity, you need to have a way of managing it so that it can be received by consumers or charities in a way that they can manage it.
I'm kind of biased because I'm on the lending side, but like the main thing would be capital. Like if we're going to start farms, you're looking at $2 to $5 million per farm. If you're talking commercial scale, we're talking about transportation or warehousing or whatever. It's money. Like we, and then the other side to money is, agricultural borrowing is completely different than commercial borrowing, where it's if you have a product, you're in the agricultural side, you're almost set to whatever the market is going to give you for it, right? It's not like, oh, I need $12 for this, pack of strawberries. You're gonna get what you get, right? So we can't longer amortization on the money, lower interest rates, those kind of things to get these farms and infrastructure and everything started.
Laurie, it just looks like you want, I don't want to ask another question because it looks like you want to add something to that. No, you're good. Okay.
Capital. Yes, capital investment. I'm just agreeing wholeheartedly.
And it's I think it's tempting for governments often to think that they need to be the solutions to the capital side, and that's not always true. I think we've seen that this week in Ottawa, where the government's kind of rolling out a sovereign wealth fund, and that seems to be kind of this idea very often is let's come up with a very big pot of money to fix things, when it's worth also reflecting on what are the barriers to capital coming into the market through or other organizations through the private sector, and fixing some of the barriers that stand in the way of other sources of capital that may be available in other places but aren't available in the Canadian context.
I'd like to just take a moment to talk a little bit more about sort of the capital and the financial aspect of providing food. One of the things that I've been thinking about lately is, we talk about having to get capital to start farms, and a comment was made to me the other day that, if you can't make money farming, you can sell your farm and someone else will take it over and keep farming. And I question whether or not that's a logical through point when we're losing so much farmland to new housing or to, other uses, land uses. I don't know enough about the financial aspect of farming, but the question that I keep coming back to is there a different way to do it to Tyler's point about providing capital and keeping people on the farms and keeping people growing food that doesn't put as much strain on them. And I'm wondering if, Camden, you might want to talk to some of those ideas you were saying about around longer amortization rates, or do we look at lower interest rates, or do we reevaluate the quote unquote value we put on food production? I don't know if I was quite articulate in that question, but hopefully you guys are following that thread of
No,
the.
I think we've had a lot of discussions about that, and I think there's just two sides to it almost, where it's one, the capital, but the other side is kind of the education piece. I think that a lot of youth, I guess I should say, don't know the opportunities in the agricultural sector, and that potentially there is a career path for someone interested in agriculture. There are ways, just being one person, to make money in the agricultural sector. I think we all now are in this, myself included, see the guy down the road that owns the whole concession, and it's like, oh, like I'm never going to get there. Like I could never get enough money. But we have clients that are motivated that, own little farms and they're making a living in agriculture. But that's not something that's taught, or you kind of have to discover it. So it's like, how do we get the education side, so people come up with these ideas and get more into agriculture, and then mix that with access to capital, and then amorts and those kind of things that will help them succeed.
But you also get into kind of the world is changing today, right? And you don't need to own land to be a farmer. I think we have this cultural association where those two things go together. And I think life is a lot better when you own farmland. As someone that owns farmland myself, I guess it's great that it keeps going up, but I'm like, people thought I was crazy when we paid what we did for our first farmland, but it's all worth more than it was worth 10 years ago. But really, that ends up being a real estate investment. I think like we have a hard time kind of thinking through this, but if we want to get into the nuts and bolts and kind of profitability and not in farming, land being worth what it is today is just like, it's hard to make the numbers work. And unless you say this land is not kind of a farming asset, but a real estate asset, and you can separate kind of the math around your real estate investment from your farming operation and how that works and how that plays out. And I think what we are going to continue to see is more people that are farming without owning the land that they own, without owning the land that they farm. And that's a cultural change that we have in agriculture. And I'm not sure that it matters or not from a resilient farming perspective. But given the value of land being what it is today, it's almost hard to kind of see what that future looks like. And again, you can talk a lot about whether or not land's more ex too expensive or not, but I don't know anybody that owns land today that wants it to be worth less.
And exactly to your point, we have one young farmer in Toronto that doesn't own any land, and every year he's made a deal with in his area that every year he rents 10 acres. He moves around the community and he does 10 acres of potatoes every year, and that's and he does really well. He's right almost in Toronto, well, the farming side of Toronto, but he has agreements with the local grocery stores, and his motto is he harvests and delivers to the store that day. He gets a premium price, and the only thing he owns is the tractor and the potato equipment, the washers, the bagger, and he doesn't own any land. So like you're saying, there, agriculture is changing, and it's, we don't need to own the land, but there's, the education piece of, hey, this, another gentleman that we financed doesn't own any land, and he's got, I think he's up to 8,000 taps now, maple syrup. He doesn't own any land. He rents out the property as well. So it's, with land prices, there are opportunities, but it's getting, the knowledge out there that, is an opportunity, and there is ways still to make money without, putting 3 million down on, 100 acres or 50 acres or even less acres now.
Space of moving there.
Yeah, I mean, again, this is just such like an interesting space around. I think one of the things that we don't talk enough about is the demographic change in agriculture that's going to happen over the next 10 years. and how that's going to change much of what happens in the sector. And I think kind of this issue around land ownership is a really good example of that, where we're going to have fewer farmers, potentially substantially fewer farmers. We're going to have bigger, more efficient, arguably more resilient farms. Lots of debate to be had around that. But that doesn't mean that we're not going to have small farms. Like, I think, again, you get into this world of we will have very few, very big farms and very many, very small farms. But that creates a more diverse sector, arguably, that does build some resilience into the system if we've got that. But they need very different things, right? And they need different supports, and they need different tools, and they need more of that education and that outreach. Cappy's counterpart in the United States, the Farm Foundation, just launched a beginning farmers program, a new farmers program, and they were hoping to get 75 entrants enrolled in it, and they ended up with more than 600 applications to the program, and they were able to get more funding for it. And many of those new entrants are kind of new to farming, coming in different production systems, looking in kind of different spaces. And this program is funded by some pretty large ag input companies and some pretty large CPG companies. And those companies came to the table with more money to support more of these new entrants into it, because they're coming in a different way. And this is kind of the future of the system is more of these new people that need new tools, new experiences, and probably have as much passion and interest and engagement as those that have been in and around agriculture all of their lives, but need more support. And so how do we make sure that we're building that and kind of taking advantage of that? And as Captain says, giving them kind of the tools, the education, the support that they need to do that.
I'm going to pull out that thread about, you know, being diverse and having more diverse agriculture that Tyler, you raised. You know, we have a lot more commodity specific or crop specific kind of farming. And I remember talking to somebody about that, you know, like maybe what we should have is more diverse farm, like more diversity within a farm. So you don't just have one piece type of livestock. You don't just have one crop. And we see some of that, but the comment made back was the industry isn't built for the diversity the way it used to, because you need crop specific machinery or livestock specific setups. Do you think the industry is nimble enough to handle this sort of transition to supporting farmers like the one that Camden was talking about, who, you know, crops 10 acre or farms 10 acre plots of potatoes? Or do you think we need to do more work around creating some nimbleness in the industry to be able to support farmers to do that?
I think, Jen, if I can start to say, I think you framed that as a question about the industry. I think it's bigger than that. So if you look at Western Canadian agriculture as an example, often you don't need kind of terribly different equipment to plant a more diverse crop rotation. Often what's missing is profitable crops. Right. And the reason why people grow type rotations is that's because that's where they're making their margins from. And that is often why we end up in the systems that we do today, is because that's where the profit is. Like if we want to fix diversity, we need to find more ways to drive up more demand and drive down costs for more products to make it different. And then the flip side is often diversity is hard, right? Again, I come from a livestock background too. Livestock production is not for the faint of heart. On a good day, right, it's tough. And so if you have the choice between making, $100 using an acre of land to grow corn and soybeans, or you have you can make $100 using that same acre of land to raise a cow, you're probably going to pick the corn and soybeans because it's just easier, right? And so it's not as simple as, I think, is the industry prepared to support it. It's complicated and it's messy. And yes, diverse systems are helpful, but they're not straightforward, and they take a lot more than kind of industry support. And we need to create the right demand and then find the right ways to support and encourage people to do that work.
I'm going to pause here for a moment because I want to switch gears. But before I do, Jesse, you've been listening into this conversation. Is there anything you want to add or any questions you'd like to ask at this point?
I mean, I think Tyler really effectively brought us to the focal point of the threads we've been discussing, which is how do you have a successful and stable food system in an increasingly complicated and chaotic world. Now, you could argue that the world has always been chaotic and complicated and we just didn't know it. And science and technology is now allowing us to measure and understand that chaos and complexity in a way that is a double-edged sword. Because on the one hand, it allows us to do things like Lori is doing at Second Harvest, which is phenomenal rerouting of food waste. And then the authority to say, hey, guys, we got too much food waste, right? I'm not sure that would have been possible until we were able to quantify exactly how much food waste was happening. But the flip side of quantification is you start recognizing that there is a lot of complexity to our systems and there's a lot of chaos to the natural world. Farming certainly was always based on certainties. I think those certainties are disappearing. Capital allocation was always based on certainties. I think those certainties are disappearing. So how do we have effective supports? How do we make capital accessible? How do we make farming in very complicated, complex times where you don't even own the land, which again is another variable? I'm the kind of crazy person who likes chaos. I think most people don't like chaos. So I'm not sure how helpful that is, but that's what I've been thinking as we've been discussing this. And I think it comes back for me to, how do we get everyone appreciating that we all belong in addressing these solutions, which again is kind of why, Lori, I admire your work so much, because you do bring together a whole bunch of different actors who might not have been talking to each other because you've got something for them to focus on that accomplishes that. I think that's a method, a strategy that we can replicate across the sector to get more of the harmonization and kind of eye to eye stuff that we need. But if I were to have that as a question, because I think that was your question, a question to the question, how do you guys deal with the chaos and complexity of your jobs? Because I think each of you individually, whether you are aware of it or not, have a certain comfort with dealing with complexity and chaos. That's why you are each succeeding at what you do. Am I projecting, or is there something that allows you to be at the eye of the storm or the center of the action and not freak out?
I guess I could start with that. I don't know. I think COVID for us anyways completely changed our outlook on food and where food comes from, and you know, all of a sudden, you know, you don't have this, you don't have that, and it's like, oh, where's that come from? It's like, well, not here. And that changed kind of, so I work with strictly First Nation communities, so it changed kind of this look at, you know, where does our food come from, and can we be self-sufficient? And it's, you know, well, we've grown to the point where that may not be possible. So then it's, well, how can we then, you know, be involved in a food system to kind of, one, support each other, but then potentially support the province, support the country. So it's on this road of discovering, you know, where do we live? Based on where we live, what can we do? You know, and it's someone, and, you know, on the North Shore is not going to be looking at the same project that someone, you know, down in Southern Ontario is going to be looking at. So it's, how can we all work together to, one, be an expert in something, to then, you know, assist everyone else, right? So it's, if you become an expert, and then, you know, and then to what Lori was saying is, you know, once you get into the size where you're doing a lot, then it's waste, right? And then where does the waste go? And, you know, we've talked about complexities, right? And it's, you know, as soon as you think you've solved one problem, there's 25 more that start, right? And it's, oh, we want to do beef. And it's like, well, where's the closest, you know, beef processing plant? Nowhere near us. So then it's like, oh, now what, you know, are we going to build one of those? Do we now need a trucking company? You know, it's trying to sort out, you know, the problems, or I don't even know if they're problems, but, you know, all the hurdles to build a system that works, right? And this also is fueled from, you know, the big grocery chains reaching out and going, oh, we want, you know, this. And it's like, if we put every First Nation producer together in this province, we would not have that many items, right? So it's, I don't know, it's an exciting time, but it's also like Jesse was saying, it's kind of chaos. And it's how are we going to work together to try to create a system that's going to support everyone, right?
I agree, but I think we're all good at what we do because we're very decisive. We're good with risk and we like change. And we recognize that change is happening constantly. And so how do you strategically manage change? And you're not always going to have the right data or the data, and you're going to make mistakes. And I think that aligns us, right? Like, everybody's okay with mistakes. You're going to make a mistake, you learn from it, and you move a different way to your course correct. And Second Harvest, like Camden, like, we shifted tremendously during COVID. We were just a small Toronto organization who went, well, here's an opportunity. We've got a big problem in this country. Let's figure out how to manage it. And the first management piece was tech, right? Like, really being open to tech. And now it's AI. And now it's like, it's always being open to recognizing that things are going to change and you have to be okay with the change. And you have to get on board early on and recognize you're going to make mistakes. But I think our biggest, probably all of us, what we're all very good at, is knowing that we're not the best and getting the right people in the room so that we can listen and they can talk to each other, because I don't think they're always in the right room. And it's like at Second Harvest, we're lucky, we're a charity. So we can get academia and government and industry and people that look like competitors in the same room working on this one problem. So like this advisory committee for, you know, doing a gap analysis on processing and manufacturing across the country, that includes everybody that's doing processing and manufacturing, or getting rid of best before dates. I never thought that would really come to be honest. And it's, you know, we're leading it with RCC, with the major retailers, with major manufacturers. Everybody's on board because they see that this is a problem. So I think that's one of the skill sets that we possess, is like, get the right people in the room and know you're never, if you're the smartest person in the room, get out of the room, man, because nothing to learn anymore.
And I think Lori talks about something that there's missing too often, right? About that need to take risks and make decisions and try things and be prepared to fail. And I think that's one of the reasons, kind of, when we look at the policy landscape in Canada, we haven't done enough of that. We don't have enough mechanisms where we can try different things and support things and embrace a little bit of failure. I think kind of governments are too risk adverse at the end of the day. But as much as there's chaos, I often think that part of the way that you deal with the chaos is remember that often the solution is go back to the basics, right? And how do you understand, you know, what the fundamentals are? And I think sometimes we do overcomplicate things too much, and we can get too daunted by it. So I think if you go back and really understand, you know, what's at the root of what we're talking about. I'm a big fan of this Einstein quote: if you have an hour to solve a problem, spend 55 minutes talking about the problem and 5 minutes talking about the solution. I think if we really understand what the issues are at the end of the day, it enables that decisiveness and that action that Lori talked about that is so tremendously important at the end of the day.
I really like that. And I want to talk about that a little bit in the context of what you said around the policy, and sometimes our governments are risk adverse. So we are currently discussing, as Canadian Agriculture, the next policy framework. We know, you know, there's a process we go through every 5 or so years for that next policy framework. And not often do we see substantial changes to that framework. We know that there's going to be a large chunk of money set aside for business risk management, but very little movement around how we can support farmers and be creative within that policy landscape. And I'm just wondering if part of the issue, if we want to think creatively and get risky, is that maybe we need to bring others into the agricultural policy, because there's very little that agriculture doesn't touch. Are we doing ourselves a disservice by negotiating a next policy framework within just the Department of Agriculture? Should we be bringing in other departments or other ministries, sorry, into that discussion to see how we could get more creative around the next policy framework?
Sorry, Jenna, that's happening. It's not just sitting in agriculture. They're bringing in all the other ministries. So I actually think this is really good that ECC, I said, and every, like, there are many, many other ministries that are informing this, even though it's sitting with ag.
Well, and I think, right, there's this interesting interplay between the food security strategy, which will be a federal strategy that goes across federal departments, and then the policy framework, which will be an agriculture strategy that goes between levels of governments, right? And we need both. We can't have 15 different federal departments negotiating with 15 different provincial departments trying to make it all work together. But what we need is this idea of how do we make sure that when agriculture departments agree to the policy framework, they're not just thinking about what's within their mandate and their area of responsibility. They're thinking about how are they working with the other government departments that they work with every day, right? If we want to talk about kind of capital and investments, there's industry departments or kind of finance departments that are involved. If we want to talk about regulations, often that's going to happen. You live without it. We talk about land use and kind of permitting issues and how important that should be to kind of an ag policy framework. The agriculture departments are really limited. And I do think one of the issues has been that we do make this too much about ag departments. So one of the things that's also happened in the meantime is that while agriculture has been talking to agriculture, everybody else has started to talk about food too. And so we can pretend like that's not already happening, but it is. I think I often look at entries in the federal lobby registry. You know, there's about 3 or 4 times more today than there was over 10 years ago when I stopped being a political staffer, right? There are more people talking about agriculture issues than there ever have been before. That's not because there are 3 or 4 times as many ag groups talking about agriculture issues. That's because there's a whole bunch of other groups that weren't talking about ag issues before that are now talking about ag issues. So they're already coming to the table and they're talking about those issues with more government departments than the agriculture department. And agriculture as a sector needs to realize that landscape has changed and kind of catch up with everybody else that's talking about these issues too.
I think there's a paradox in agriculture embracing the phrase agri-food, because on the one hand, it asserts the role that agriculture plays in the food system. But on the other hand, it does acknowledge that there are a whole bunch of other people at the policy table. And on the one hand, to Lori's point, that process is already happening. But on the other hand, I think there are opportunities that the agricultural sector are not taking advantage of, both to raise the profile of agricultural actors, but also to speak to a cliche, to achieve innovation by learning from each other. In that, I still think agriculture suffers from a we know what we're doing, we're the experts, rather than let's learn from other experts so that we can build compounded expertise across sectors, which is starting, but I still think has a lot of work. So to frame that as a question, what could we be doing better to get collaboration, not as it exists now, but as it exists in the compounded sense of the whole being greater than the sum of its parts? Unless someone wants to argue that we are already doing that.
I mean, Lori, you're doing some of that, right? But the problem is, that kind of continues to be an isolated case. And a lot of people that think about ag issues often think that kind of the ag issues stop at the farm gate, when yet that food needs to go many different places before it gets to the consumers that are actually going to consume it.
I think on our side, I think that we don't have enough experts, and the experts that we do have are now like 80 plus. And it's how are we getting the expertise from the 80 year olds down to the 20 year olds. There's a spiked interest in agriculture all of a sudden. But there's the knowledge, it's skipped about 2 generations. And we're trying to catch up on, you know, back when everyone grew up on a farm, not everyone, but a lot of people grew up on a farm. Now that number's dwindling, and these individuals looking to go back. It's so in a small, super small scale in the First Nation community, we're saying, you know, how can we keep these 2 farmers that are farming, or not farming, but how can we utilize them to try to educate, you know, 100 people, right? that might not be relevant to kind of the outlook of on a government level, how that's happening, but we're, you know, on a smaller scale, how do we grow it? That's kind of what we're battling at the moment.
I think Camden made a really good point in terms of expertise and knowledge. And I think a lot of the agricultural sector kind of takes that expertise for granted, partly because it is very transparent. And I say that from my own firsthand experience as a novice farmer, that all the knowledge is at my fingertips. But Lori, I'm curious to throw it to you in terms of the knowledge around food waste, because I kind of feel that the core mission of Second Harvest has been educating the industry around the options around how to do food waste. What is the expertise level there? Because I almost think that the expertise around food waste is kind of taken for granted, but is increasingly valuable to the sector as a whole.
Well, I mean, I will say when I started talking about this 10 years ago, nobody was talking about it. It just wasn't a thing. It was just the cost of doing business and wasn't taken into account. So I'm delighted to say it's changed a lot, right? Industry is seeing this as an economic outcome, that they would have better economic outcomes with less waste. And so there is measurement. There is, you know, it's attached to their CSR and their other goals. So I think food waste at least has come a long, long way in terms of even acknowledging that it's a thing that we shouldn't be doing. Having said that, again, I'm still stuck with it is not consistent. And I'm Second Harvest. I mean, we're very much focused on the data. What is it? Where is it? Here's some recommendations, but we don't go into your business. There's great places like EnviroStewards that I'll go into your business and say, hey, if you fix these three things, which your frontline people have known about for years, by the way, you will save money, right? So great case study at Campbell's Soup, where there was a line of carrots maybe one time, and then when they changed the line, it turned to tomatoes, and those carrots would pop out anyway out of the line, and they would just throw them away. Well, I mean, I think we all know if you just put them over there and use them for your carrot soup later, or whatever the commodity was, and they saved $250,000 a year. So now that you're seeing this economic benefit, I think there is definitely more interest in that. But that's, you know, our role is, if you have it, how do we manage it and get it to charities and tell you at least that you have it? And there is improvement, right? When we did the first research, it was 58% of all food that was produced for Canadians was wasted or lost or wasted, depending on how you frame it. 58 down to 46.5 is still pretty significant in 5 years, which is great. Had we done the research today and we said, oh, it's almost 50%, it would have been outrageous. But I see this as things are moving in the right direction, for sure. They are trending in the right direction. And that's because industry is talking. Everybody's talking about it now. It's fantastic.
I think the other side to this is potentially the CRA. I don't do a lot with taxes and whatnot in my position, but it was kind of what started us down this road in the community side was we have an off reserve farmer who does chickens, quota holder does chickens, and he raises for Costco. And you know, we've all, you know, the Costco chickens are quite massive. And I just asked him, like, oh, what happens to the chickens that don't get big enough? And he goes, well, I just have to throw them out. And he said, well, why do you have to throw them out? And he's like, because it by the CRA demands that it's, you know, goes away. And it's just like mind-blowing how many chickens that because of tax, he just has to write them as a loss. So it's like if we got smarter with, you know, ways of tracking loss, like, because they're not lost, they're perfectly fine. They're the same size as what you would buy at Foodland. They're just not in the contract size that Costco wants. Right. And I have no idea what the solution is to this or how we go about that, but just opened my eye.
There's a couple of things. One, they don't have to destroy them. They can donate them. And then there is a tax credit, like a farmer tax credit. Unfortunately, I mean, fortunately, it's in Ontario, but it's not across the board. And so there is an outlet for that chicken. So you can donate them. And it was the last minister of ag, whose name escapes me in Ontario for some reason, was doing communications to farms to let them know, right? If they're insured and they need their insurance money, they still get it but they don't have to destroy it. They can donate it. So I think there's just a lack of information about that across like the whole farming sector about what you can do, and you will not be penalized. You will actually end up ahead because you'll still get a tax credit.
That's good to hear. And that was a couple years ago. Hopefully they're doing that. But yes, back to the education piece, right? What they can do.
Tyler, I see you leaning in there. Is there something you want to add?
Well, again, I think it goes back to, I was thinking again as kind of Laura and Cam were talking, right? Like this isn't rocket science, right? Like we know how to fix these things. Right? Let's just make sure that there are no disincentives standing in the way for people to donate these things. Like it shouldn't be hard to fix these things when we know that there is a problem. We just need to change the rules. I don't know, Lori, what would have been standing in the way of people being able to kind of get that benefit from donating food rather than having to destroy it. But if like these seem like, often I hear these things and I go like, I don't know, doesn't seem like that complicated. We just need to be prepared to actually act and do it. And that can fix so many things if we just, again, go back to the decisiveness point. Once we understand that there's a problem, let's just fix it. And we don't need to think about it too much, too often.
Is it really that easy though, Tyler, to just fix it? Like, it just feels like if that was we might be in a different place if that was actually true.
Far more often than we think it is, we can just fix things. You know, there's a bit of a movement in the federal government these days that we need to do pilot projects. Everything needs a pilot project before we do it. And somebody pointed out to me not too long ago, this like, or we could just do things. And, you know, like I think sometimes we overcomplicate the process. Like, you know, there's, you get some of these, as they look at regulatory reform, this comes up. It's like, let's change the regulations for a year and see what happens. Or we could just change the regulations. And a year from now, they don't work. We could change them back. But we seem to have this idea that we can only do things once and we have to get it right, 100% right the first time we do things, rather than saying like, no, if this is a problem, let's change it. And if it creates another problem, because often it does, and we don't, going back to kind of the comments about expertise, like these are complicated systems and we don't always know what the consequences of our actions are going to be. And there are sometimes unintended consequences, despite years of study and best effort. And we just need to stop letting that get in the way and just start doing things. And again, I go back to kind of the food waste example, where I think that often we haven't thought about this as much as we should. And we can, I think it's probably a space that's ripe for overstudy and overcomplication, or it could be a space that's ripe for just doing things. And man, like, I really wish that it's there. And I'll say, but like, I think the agriculture industry's part of the problem on this, because I think you will hear lots of people say that there's like consultation fatigue in the federal government and they're like tired of consultations that go on and on and on. But like, don't you dare not consult, because that's not good either, right? And so how do you kind of find the right balance, and how do you kind of find the right way of doing these things that make sure that there's, you know, like nothing crazy happening, but a lot of it's common sense and we just need to be prepared to do it.
Tyler, I love that. I've listened to each of your podcasts before asking you to come onto this one, and that sometimes we just have to do it is gonna stick in my mind, the way that Lori's comment about best before dates is sort of front of mind for me now. Along that vein, I think that we're closing in on the hour here. I wanna just ask each of you, like, if you could have one thing that you could just do, what would that one thing be? Or what's that one thing you wish policymakers and the government would just do so that your lives aren't as chaotic and your work gets easier? Camden, I'll start with you.
I'm not even sure, really. You know, we have a different, completely different battle with on reserve things that, you know, I don't think we're gonna solve anytime soon. But no, I mean, the big thing for us right now is we're really fighting for capital and getting money into First Nations, and instead of the usual projects, we're trying to just push agriculture and get that into the front of mind, that there is viability in agriculture, and it's, you know, we all have to eat every single day, and everyone sees the prices. So that's, there is an opportunity, and that's really just what we're pushing and trying to get First Nations back on, you know, creating their own food and kind of being leaders is what we're pushing. So,
awesome, Lori.
From a Canadian standpoint, I mean, Second Harvest over here, a harmonized accounting of food waste in this country and every area of the supply chain and a goal, right? Let's monitor that goal and manage it. So that's just huge, but that will prevent and minimize food waste significantly. So that's what I think Canada needs, and I think we need that soon. Second Harvest, again, I'm like cabinet, we're a charity. We always need money. We're going to have to deal with 20 million pounds of potatoes just in the prairies from now until August. And they're, you know, they're not washed and they're not bagged. And so how do we ensure that we can get those to charities across the country, I mean, in the prairies anyway, in a way that they can receive them? So it's really capital investments and logistics and supply chain, and the cost of gas and fuel is going up. And so really understanding that supply chain is very different than it was 5 years ago. Cost of a truck used to be 130, now it's 250 a reefer. So it's always going to be more money and more food through the pipeline to make sure that we can get it out to people that need it.
I mean, this may be a bit of a cop out, but I think that the thing that needs to happen is things need to happen. You know, I think that there's just really, as somebody said earlier, right, there's often no one right answer to these things, that we just need to kind of get on with it and do things. And so, I don't know, governments may do things that I don't like, but I would much rather they do things that I don't like than they do nothing at all. And too often we fall into the nothing at all world. And so if we can embrace some change and kind of be prepared to leave the status quo, I think that sets the conditions for many other things to have happen. But, you know, that's harder said than done. Or easier said than done.
Thank you all for your time today. I appreciate your patience as I did navigate some technology issues. Jesse, I am going to turn it over to you now.
You know, Tyler said something early on in the episode that we have to think about the difference between what's easy and what's impactful. And I've been thinking about that a lot through the course of the conversation. And I think we ended on the mutual inclusivity idea that whether it's easy or whether it's impactful, just do it. Right? Find that action and maybe alternate between the two. But I find my privilege in having these conversations with leaders is the recurring theme that I keep getting is every leader, especially those present, really underestimate how brilliant, how inspiring, and how important you guys are to the sector. And I say this because I think if we want to be serious about inspiring action, whether at the government level or at the industry level, we have to acknowledge social license. A lot of people feel that they need permission to act. They need permission to lead. They need permission to do things differently. We don't. We clearly don't feel we need permission, but I think we should be telling other people that they don't need permission, that they need to go out and be the change that they want to be. So thanks again, everybody. Another fantastic episode of The Future Herd, and we'll see y'all soon.